Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Broadcast. This is Kevin Swanson. I'm a homeschool father of five, educating my children during the breakdown of Western civilization, the breakdown of an entire civilization, the breakdown of the Christian faith, and the great breakdown of a biblical worldview. And the humanists are taking over, but doing a really bad job with it and ruining our socioeconomic systems because they have abandoned the old wisdom of God's laws. And a lot of that is due to the fact that education has been thoroughly secularized and humanized, such that God's law and God's truth and God's way of looking at life has been virtually ignored in the history classes, in the science classes, in all of the classes, pretty much. And we no longer integrate God's word into every experience in our children's lives. And that's the Deuteronomy 6-7 principle that we bring back all the time. You've got to integrate the reality of God into things. And if you don't begin with the beginning of wisdom and knowledge as the fear of God, if the beginning of knowledge is a condom, you're probably in the wrong school. Because the beginning of wisdom and the beginning of knowledge in every single class has got to be not only a recognition that God exists, but a fear of God, a reverence for God. That's Solomon, that's the wisest man who ever lived, and of course one of the wisest books ever written was the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 1:7 is a book on the education of a young man, and it is a book that purports to bring out the principles relating to knowledge and wisdom. And the most basic principle in sharing knowledge and wisdom is the beginning, and that is the fear of God. Well, that's not being taught in American public schools all that much. So walk into the principal's office and ask them if the beginning of knowledge, the foundation of all learning in this institution, is the fear of God. If it's not, get away from there. Get out. I don't care if you're a teacher or a student. Get out. Get out. Get away from it as fast as you possibly can. If the beginning of wisdom and knowledge is the fear of God. Well, friends, unfortunately, we've got a huge amount of centralization going on, which means that at one time, you could have teachers in local school districts, in small little schools like Laura Ingalls Wilder out in North Dakota, and you could bring out the McGuffey readers, and you could have your own little school, and nobody really controlled you from Washington, D.C., or the State Department of Education. But we've had huge amounts of standardization, centralization going on, which means that whoever's in power, and whatever ideologies in power is going to be imposed on all these little school districts, and school teachers all around America. And that's been increasing all the way since the 1900s, early 1900s, when you had school districts and departments of education that formed in all 50 states. And then the federal Department of Education took over because, again, we're trying to uniform the form of education that we teach. We're trying to find ways to standardize. And again, it's Republicans that seem to be out in the forefront of this, as well as Democrats. But, Dave, here's an interesting chart from the Heritage Foundation. I was amazed because I wanted to revisit what was happening with the National Department of Education. With a constant increase in the power of federal government over all the states and the state departments of education, the state departments of just about whatever. And it's typically money that drives everything. Money drives everything in Washington. So if you want to know whether or not we've had more centralization and standardization of education, yeah, you have to look at what has happened in the funding of the National Department of Education. And according to this chart, Dave, adjusted for inflation, what we have seen is a massive increase under George W. Bush around the year 2000 up to about 2004 or so. It flatlined ever since. In other words, under George W. Bush, the increase of federal funding of education was threefold. That was 300%. It went from about $35 billion or $30 billion in roughly 2000 or maybe 1998. About 1998, it was right around $35 billion, and George W. Bush took it all the way up to approximately $65 billion. So what's that? An increase of twofold. A 200% increase there on the amount of money spent on education, and that's adjusted for inflation in 2012 dollars. An increase of 200% funding of education under George W. Bush, and it has flatlined ever since. In other words, what we've seen is Obama has been a good president compared to George W. Bush, although not a conservative president. I want to point out that Obama is not conservative. Some of you hope that he'd been conservative and done better than George W. Bush. He didn't. He did better in the sense that he didn't increase the budget as George W. Bush did, twofold from his administration. But what we find with Obama is he flatlined it, meaning, again, he's not a conservative. A true conservative, I think, would scale back the control of government in our lives, and that did not happen with Barack Obama. And I'm sure there are a lot of folks who voted for Barack Obama disappointed because of that.
Probably. Now, under George W. Bush, I think the increase was mostly due to his No Child Left Behind, or what it's also called is All Your Children Are Belong to Us bill.
Yeah.
No child left out of the government schools, which means no freedom to educate your own children. George W. Bush, of course, was no friend of conservatism. Now, let's go back a couple presidents, because, as you know, under Ronald Reagan had appointed somebody, a czar, so to speak, to shut down the Department of Education.
It was Bill Bennett.
Ronald Reagan believed that the federal government had no role in education.
Yeah.
And so he was going to shut down the Department of Education. He takes this young guy, up-and-comer, a lawyer, Bill Bennett, and says, Bill Bennett, I want you to shut down the Department of Education. Bill Bennett comes back to Ronald Reagan. He's been commissioned to do this.
Yes.
And he comes back and he says, you know, we can't do that. The people won't like it. What we need to do instead is try and grab this tiger by the tail and control it. And so Bill Bennett pumped money into the Department of Education, hoping that Republicans would be kinder tyrants than Democrats. And ever since then, Republicans have walked away from the principles of limited government. And this is indicative of the divide in the Republican Party. Instead of limited government, unlimited Republican influence in government.
The Heritage Foundation, friends, the Heritage Foundation is communicating to us the trends over the last several administrations. It turns out that Barack Obama did better than George W. Bush, flatlined the funding of the Department of Education adjusted for inflation over the last 4 years, but George W. Bush increased it 200% during his reign as George II, President of the United States. Well, we just bring this out because people have this mistaken impression that Republicans are conservative in the area of government spending, and that's not the case. So just be aware of that. There are Republicans, I think, that are conservative, and I back some of them myself, but generally speaking, I don't think they are conservative. So just people need to remember that Republicans and Democrats, almost not a dime's worth of difference between the parties. Now, in just a moment, friends, we're going to talk about the government's role in education and whether or not homeschool students should study to become teachers in public schools. And we're seeing a lot of this, Dave. A lot of this. I know a lot of homeschoolers are very, very excited about the public schools, and they're raising their sons and daughters to really get behind the public schools and do as much as they can to strengthen the public schools in the generation to come. A lot of homeschoolers have a vision for public schooling and government control over education. And they train their sons and daughters to be public school teachers. We're going to talk about that in just a moment on Generations. Stay with us.
I have always felt that doubt was the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of God was the end of wisdom.
Clarence Darrow.
The only true wisdom is knowing that you know nothing.
Socrates.
Belief is the death of intelligence.
Robert Anton Wilson.
If thou trustest to the book called the Scriptures, thou trustest to the rotten staff of fables and falsehood.
Thomas Paine.
Faith is believing what you know ain't so.
Mark Twain.
Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered.
God.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
God.
The fool believes his own ideas to be wisdom, but those who fear God and search for understanding find true wisdom. To lead your family in the pursuit of godliness, pick up a copy of Proverbs Study Guide at generationswithvision.com.
And we are back on the Generations broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host with you. Dave Buhner also in studio. And people wonder sometimes why we homeschool our children out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado. And my answer is, hey, it's really God's preferred method is a discipleship-based method. And Deuteronomy 6:7 indicates that parents ought to be integrated into the education of those children. Deuteronomy 6:7 is God's standard of education, and that is God's word ought to be integrated, and parents ought to be integrated into the education of children. You shall teach your children my words diligently as you sit in the house, as you walk by the way, as you rise up, as you lie down. God wants his word as a frontlet between their eyes. That is, there should be no class, no geography class, history class, science class. There should be no experience in your child's life where he feels like he is separated from the truth of God and the truth of God's reality. That's what you get in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 7 through 9. This is God's way of raising a child. He doesn't want our children to get the idea that God shows up on a Sunday, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, people can live without God, as if God's a non-factor in the psychology class, in the geography class, in the history class, or the literature class. And of course, what we saw in the McGuffey readers, what we saw in American education up through 1900 was an inculcation of a biblical way of thinking and the reality of God in those McGuffey readers. That was happening within education for about 300 years of American history until 1900. And after 1900, we began to see the gradual, and eventually it became quicker, but a removal of references to God in the American school textbooks. Now, John Dewey was behind this, Dave, and John Dewey was a very, very important element of education in America, a public education in America. And it is illegal to bring the Bible into the education of a child. In America, you cannot bring the law of God or the word of God into the classroom and say this is the authoritative basis for truth in science classroom. This is the authoritative basis for truth in the history class. You cannot do that. That's against the law in America. Now, there are those teachers that break the law, but my guess is they're few and far between. Well, John Dewey was a committed humanist, and he wrote this in the Humanist Manifesto 1, the universe is self-existing and not created. What's the first thing you think of, Dave, when he says the universe is self-existing and not created? Man is part of nature and has emerged as a result of a continuous process. Well, what do you think when you hear that?
Where did the universe come from?
It's self-existing, not created.
Huh.
There's no God. There's no God over it. See, this again is the religion of the men who formed the modern public education system. This is their religion. People say, well, public education is not religious. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, yeah, of course it's religious. Everything is religious. And the guy who started American public education taught that the universe is self-existing and not created. He says, oh, holding an organic view of life, humanists find that the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected. That is, everything is materialistic. There is nothing spiritual. There is no soul about a human being. The nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural or cosmic guarantee of human values. That is the source of ethics, the source of human values. Is not going to be supernatural. We cannot have a supernatural source of human values. They rejected this. John Dewey signed the Humanist Manifesto 1. John Dewey was a committed religious humanist, and he denied that God could be the source of ethics. It was very, very basic for public education and public education's roots. The nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural guarantee of human value. A socialized and cooperative economic order must be established to the end that equitable distribution of the means of life be possible. That is, of course, Marxism or socialism. Man, finally, is at last becoming aware that he alone is responsible for the realization of the world of his dreams and that he has within himself the power for its achievement. That means man is not only the source of his own ethics, man is the source of his own reality. Man will direct where he will go. Man will form his own dreams. Thank you very much. God can stay out of it. Or any supernatural will stay out of it. Man will determine where he will go. And man has it within his own power. He doesn't need God. Get out of the way, God. Man has it within his own power to sovereignly ordain the future, thus such that he will obtain his own goals, his own dreams, the dreams that he has set out for himself. Dave, I mean, that is the most self-conscious humanist document ever produced, and it was produced by the father of modern education, John Dewey.
John Dewey wanted to accomplish something that was a hope and change kind of accomplishment. He wanted to create a social system using the education system to do it. He wanted to create a society where there was no fear of God. So what he did is he tried to create an education where there was no fear of God. That was his goal. Now, he was a big follower of Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. And Nietzsche is famous for saying God is dead. Not only did Nietzsche say God is dead, he said that we can also smell his rotting corpse.
Mm-hmm.
So Nietzsche was no fearer of God.
Yeah, I think that's obvious from that statement. Yeah, I think that would be obvious. We would all agree with that.
Right. You know, Nietzsche says things
Nietzsche,
like...
Nietzsche did not fear God. Dave said something very brave, very courageous. Yeah, I'm out on a limb now, but Nietzsche did not fear God.
Nietzsche said God is dead, and the only human motivation is the will to power. The will to power. And that explains a lot about our society right now. It is not a will to freedom. It is a will to power. Now, what is power? But control. Control over your environment, control over your neighbor, control over society. John Dewey, taking the philosophy of Nietzsche, wanted to take control over a society without a fear of God. That was his goal.
Ladies and gentlemen, what we're talking about now will be a part of a worldview curriculum that I'm presenting for high school students. I have worked thousands of hours on this curriculum, and it will be produced in the next several months. So stay tuned. We are going to root and ground our young people in a proper view of a biblical worldview, but also we want them to see the antithesis. We want them to see these competing worldviews that have been incredibly destructive in the Western world. We want them to understand these things, because if they don't understand the doctrine, I mean, what John Dewey taught, and understand it from a biblical framework, they may actually grow up and become public school teachers. Dave, imagine homeschoolers growing up to be public school teachers and wanting to contribute to what John Dewey presented as the vision for social education. He used the word social education. He believed that the number one purpose for the school in his pedagogic creed was the social training of the child. That's the number one. Number one, we've got to socially train the child. That's why the number one question to the average homeschooler is, what about socialization? Because everybody knows that the public schools are social environments. They're not meant for academics primarily. And that's what he says in his pedagogic creed. He says very explicitly that he did not intend for this to be primarily for academics. Public education is a social experience, friends. And whether you get it in K-12 schools or you got to push it off to college, the humanists that form the modern college situation and the modern K-12 schools clearly intended for the social experience to be the primary objective of the public schools. That was the distinct opinion of John Dewey. I believe that the school is primarily a social institution. I believe that the school is primarily a social institution. Dave, he would have agreed enthusiastically with Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto when he said, replace home education with social. Again, replace home education with social. This is the Communist Manifesto, the very heart of the Communist Manifesto. This is what the Communist Manifesto was all about. If you're a Marxist, you're going to very much appreciate this. If you're a communist, you're going to very much appreciate this. The public schools are meant to be what Karl Marx said when he said, get rid of home education and replace home education with social. It's the social experience that is primary in the public schools today, as it was with John Dewey and Karl Marx. Dave, why do homeschoolers study to become public school teachers? Why do homeschool moms and dads bring their kids home and say, we're going to train you, we're going to teach you so that you can be public school teachers? I don't understand that.
Well, Kevin, I think part of it is that a fish doesn't know he's wet, and he always wants to return to the water as soon as he learns what dry means. Homeschool students don't really understand the battle. They don't understand it at a philosophical level and an intellectual level. They're learning some things. They're getting good grades. They're getting well-socialized, where they can speak to different groups very well. But they're not powerful. They're not in control. This was the goal of Dewey. But they see that if they could get a hold of the public schools, perhaps they could make a positive change, yeah, a positive control. And I think in that regard, some of the motivations are the same. Now, I think when we talk about social education, we need to understand what's really happening here. Social is the antithesis of familial. Mm-hmm. A family. Now, what's happening here is the institution of the family is being systematically disassembled.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing you do is you take children out, you give them an education, a social education. Well, that destroys the family. It destroys it economically. It destroys its purpose. One of the purposes of the family is to raise a godly seed.
Davis, you bring that up. I just have an article in front of me from Chalcedon Reports. And this guy is writing on the vision for education. Colonel Francis Parker was a Civil War veteran, and he was one of the seminal thinkers in the evolution of public education. Colonel Francis Parker, this is what he said. A school should be a model home, a complete community of embryonic democracy. Now, the National Education Association in 1891 opposed him. on this. They opposed him. Believe it or not, the NEA opposed him on this vision years ago because they said it would take way too much money to turn the state into the incubator for a new social situation for a child. But Colonel Parkle's vision was to replace the home with the school, to be sure that the average person, average kid, from the time he was in kindergarten or in preschool or in daycare, was raised in an environment that did not include a family, that were trained to think and to act like a citizen of a large central socialist state. This was the vision of Colonel Parker and others who brought about the modern social education system. Of course, John Dewey was the one who ultimately was able to launch such a system. Dave, I think the other reason, yeah, as you said, is that they want to change the system. But, it's sort of like trying to be a chaplain in a whorehouse. It can be difficult. Now, I'm not saying that you should not be the chaplain for a den of prostitution or a place in which the fear of God is not practiced. I mean, would you agree that the fear of God probably not practiced or not experienced or not exemplified with prostitutes in a whorehouse?
Let me put it to you this way, Kevin. If you were asked to be the chaplain to the White House, I would say go get him. Which is akin to being a chaplain in a whorehouse.
Right. Okay, so there may be a role from time to time, if they're listening, if the inmates are listening, there may be a role. But to be the chaplain, Dave, I'm not sure this is necessarily the best thing. I'm wondering sometimes if these public school teachers, these Christians who get into the public schools, are really trying to change the system or if they're just part of the system.
Well, that's a good question. I think we have to deal with that on an individual basis.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that a public school teacher is a pretty easy ride through life, economically speaking. It's, you get paid well, you get good benefits, you get a lot of time off. The work isn't all that strenuous. You don't have a boss yelling at you constantly, breathing down your neck. If your kids don't learn how to do differential equations by Friday, it's not like the whole school falls apart like it might be in business. If you don't get a project done, there are real economic consequences. So by and large, it's a fairly easy walk through life.
Dave, there's a website called MyCentralJersey.com. This is New Jersey. In Edison Township, 99 school employees were making more than $100,000 this year, including 27 teachers earning as much as $114,000. Okay, that's New Jersey. In Colorado, the average teacher makes anywhere from $36,000 to $65,000 per year. And Dave, if you adjust for the 9 months they're working, in other words, they're working 9 months, they take 3 months off. So if you adjust for that, here's the salary of the average public school teacher directly out of the public schools or out of the university. They're starting at $53,000 per year, and they go up to about $86,000 or $90,000 per year. So anywhere from $53,000 to $90,000 a year, and that again takes the ratio of 12-9, 12 months over the 9 months they're actually working. If they worked in other things, for the other 3 months, they could be making some other income. But for the 12 months, they're working at an annual rate of $53,000 a year just out of college. That's pretty good. For just out of college, when I got out of college, I was making something like $30,000 a year. Now, granted, there's been inflation since then, but $53,000 per year just out of college in the state of Colorado is actually pretty good income. Or they can make up to, say, $86,000, $90,000, $95,000 per year in the state of Colorado. That's pretty good income for somebody with a liberal arts degree. And again, I think what's happening is people get a liberal arts degree, which is one of the easiest degrees to get, no question about it. You get a liberal arts degree, about the only thing you can do is teach or work at McDonald's, or maybe even, ask the proverbial question, will that be plastic or paper, in a Safeway checkout line.
Right. So you add to that one of the best benefit packages in any industry, and you can see that there is an incentive for people to go into that field.
Forgot about that, yeah.
Now, is that motivating? I mean, how much does it motivate them? I can't say. I question whether or not we want the government schools being run by homeschooled Christians, or if we'd really like to be opposing them a little more in their face.
Dave, I think one of the problems is that homeschoolers are so focused on the liberal arts. And I think this is an issue we have to look at. Liberal arts plays such a huge part in the preparation of a child for life. Liberal arts is huge. I mean, liberal arts is what we've been told to teach our children through K-12 studies. Maybe our children, and liberal arts is not all that practical. As I said, it's probably good for a paper or plastic question on a checkout line at Safeway, or maybe flipping burgers at McDonald's, or teaching for $53,000 a year out of college. But outside of that, Dave, I'm not sure liberal arts buys you all that much. So if you get a kid who's halfway decent with liberal arts, then that's about all you're doing. You're doing a little math, but you're generally doing a lot of liberal arts. You do all this liberal arts, and your kid turns out to be very, very good at liberal arts. What is he going to do? Probably something less practical than a lot of the other things available for people to do in life. And that happens to be teaching on the island of education where life integration doesn't really happen. Personally, I think that we need to have a much more life-integrated form of education rather than moving education onto an island. Keep education within the spheres of life. You say, what's life? Family, church, business. That's pretty much life. That's where life really happens. What is school? I don't know. It's an island out there somewhere, and people with white coats teach you things, and it turns out that if you can't work, teach. If you can't teach, write a textbook. That's what I was always told when I was attending college. I had a number of teachers that were, you know, in the marketplace. They come in to teach part-time, and they sort of tongue-in-cheek would say, if you can't work, I guess you teach. If you can't teach, write a textbook. And they complain about the textbooks because they were typically very, very badly written. But,
right, but you and I both know a man who did an excellent job writing a textbook series, so we don't
want to say anything bad about him. But here, it's the defense of something practical, Dave. I think we ought to be doing some stuff that's practical and prepare our children to do practical stuff. You do that. You've done that with your boys.
It's beyond that, Kevin. I think part of this is understanding that we're responsible for our own. A lot of people will go into teaching, I think, because they love children, which is great. You should love children. Now have some.
Yeah, exactly. Have some children.
And if God's closed the womb, adopt some. Yeah. You know, and then go home and raise them. Yeah. And now you find out what real education is like because you're dealing with the character of it.
Right.
You talk about a practical education with my boys, my two oldest. I featured a lot more math than I have spelling. Now that makes for some funny moments when it comes to writing, but my boys are both doing much better at mathematics and practical skills, business skills, construction skills, things that will give them the opportunity to provide for a family and take some dominion. Now, it's not that you can't take dominion in literature. You can take dominion in literature, but you're not going to probably be the next great best-selling author. You're probably not going to write the next best book on philosophy if you haven't done some practical things.
Dave, I'd like to address one more thing on the area of education before we leave this program, and that is Christian colleges. Christian colleges not doing well. Christian college is not doing well, most of which, by the way, are liberal arts colleges. And I've said this before, friends, they're not doing well financially. They're very financially unstable. Calvin College is not doing well. Westmont College, not doing well at all. In fact, they are financially unsustainable at this point. Colorado Christian University, not doing well. They're at risk. Wheaton College, at risk. Covenant College, Baylor, Azusa Pacific. A lot of these Christian colleges, friends, financially unstable. They're on the wrong path when it comes to economics. And I think that's because of a lot of different things. Number one, college is not very good at preparing children for their future life. And we've done so many programs on that. We're not going to repeat that again. But, Dave, I think what's happening here is that people are, number one, losing interest in Christian colleges for several reasons. One, they're very expensive, and they've gotten very expensive. Remember, the average college cost in America has increased threefold the CPI, three times the consumer price index or the inflation index since the 1970s. So you have the consumer price index going up like this, the cost of things and this, the amount of money you get when you get out of the college and get a job for the first time, that's gone up at a slight little rate at the CPI, roughly, but then you have college costs way, way exponentially above the CPI. College costs have gone up so much, I don't think people want to send their kids to these colleges, and the economic situation certainly is not making it easy. Moreover, when the kids get out of college, they have a hard time getting the job, and it's much, much, much harder to get employment these days unless you get involved in college. Plus, and the mentorship programs that we talk about ad nauseum on this program, unless you get out of the box and start doing things in the economy, I mean practical things, not just doing some liberal arts major where you get out making $12 an hour as a checkout clerk at Safeway. No, I'm talking about practical work along the way as you engage a practical degree that will actually get you somewhere in the macroeconomy. Friends, I think these colleges are in trouble. And I think a lot of people are asking the question, why go to a Christian college when you can get evolution cheaper at public colleges? I know that's tongue-in-cheek, Dave, but there are a lot of these Christian colleges. Remember, twice as many liberal arts professors and religious department heads in Christian colleges believe in evolution than do the science department heads. I mean, meaning that, meaning the liberal arts departments, the religious departments, are far, 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 far more liberal. They are far more liberal, even than the science department heads. Why? Because Christian colleges are liberal, because their professors have been trained in the liberal universities, and so all you're getting is a little more expensive liberal education in the Christian colleges. Now, that's not every Christian college. There are exceptions, and people always say, yeah, but there's Hillsdale, or yeah, but there's this college or that college. I've had people, you know, say Grove City College. You know, they throw out examples where there are maybe some good things happening here and there. But by and large, friends, Christian colleges are a ripoff. I don't know, Dave. Am I getting in trouble now?
You are, because you have too many friends who run Christian colleges.
I know.
So no offense towards Patrick Henry or any of those who are our friends.
Yeah. We love our friends.
We love our friends, and we hope the best for you. But, Kevin, I think the question has to be asked, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem?
Yeah.
This is the question that Tertullian asked. And when we take the system of the Athenians, which is the system of Plato, which is fatherlessness, let's give it a name, fatherlessness, and we try and impose a little bit of Christianity on it, we're antithetical. See, God is very concerned with the family. He's very concerned about us not perpetuating fatherlessness. In fact, he represents himself to us as a father. Mm-hmm. He really is interested in fathers who don't divorce their wives. He's really interested in fathers who raise their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. He's really interested in fathers protecting their family and providing for their family. What does Athens have to do with that? Well, Athens would set up a system of fatherlessness where father is not involved in education, where father really doesn't protect. We have a government for that. You know, we have a government to protect us, and it doesn't have to provide. We have welfare for that. And he doesn't really have to have a wife. We have prostitutes for that. And this is all Plato. This is all the kind of view that Dewey was imposing. Now, should Christians swim in that sewer?
Yeah, but Dave, a lot of these girls want to go to college to find a husband, and there are young men, Christian men, that want to go to these colleges to find a wife. And of course, Christian girls have fewer tattoos than what you find in the public schools, I guess.
Right, and they're not as tattooed yet. They haven't been away from home this long. Yeah. Look, I got another suggestion. You want to meet a good Christian man? Attend church.
Yeah.
And maybe be part of a...
But that's a different social situation. Dave, I have found that a lot of college students, kids that go to colleges, have a hard time working into churches that have a highly family-integrated approach, where there are lots of families. Because, again, they're not living in a family-oriented structure. Their social situation is not family-based. They're living in this independent lifestyle away from the family, and so they develop a very, very independent viewpoint of life for those years that they're independent in the college scene.
And Kevin, I have an electronic concordance right here, and it turns out the word independent really doesn't appear in the Old and New Testament.
Well, it depends. At one point, 1 Corinthians 11, the man is not independent of the woman. The woman is not independent of the man.
Oh,
so outside of that.
Preceded by the word not.
Yeah, exactly. It's the only use of the word independent in the Bible, as far as I can tell. Well, friends, I think what's happening is we are finding that the brick-and-mortar approach is getting more and more expensive. It's more and more useless. And it really doesn't portray a biblical worldview and a biblical social view as it ought to. Now, there's ways in which we can give our children higher education. And I'm a strong believer in giving higher education and more intensive forms of education, including liberal arts education, that is, study in the area of philosophy and literature and so forth. I think that's good. And I have a philosophy and literature curriculum that I'm developing with a strong antithetical edge to it, where I set the scriptural biblical worldview against all these foreign worldviews that have corrupted the modern world. And I think we ought to train our children in some of these more difficult views and understandings of some of these more difficult philosophies, and hopefully with the apologetic ability to cast down some of these imaginations. So I believe in this form of education, but not apart from the practical edge. I think life integration is important, not apart from a biblical worldview. I think we ought to retain a strong antithetical viewpoint against the ideas of the world that have corrupted the modern world. I believe that we ought to give some form of education, but does it have to be a brick and mortar? Do we have to put our kids in the dorms? Do we have to be sure that our children get into risky environments where they're not really nurtured into life, and where they're not going to be married, and where they're not going to mature, and where they're not going to have adults mentoring and discipling them along the way? Do we have to do that? It's my only question. And do we have to do it for an arm and a leg? And it appears that these Christian colleges aren't going to sustain anyway, and so we better come up with a plan B. And, Dave, I think we're going to see a decentralization of these large Christian colleges to the point where we're going to have more discipleship centers and small shepherd centers, much like what we're doing here. And I realize that we're just one out of several across the entire country. One day, friends, there will be tens of thousands of the sorts of things that we're doing in discipling young men in our basement, providing shepherding, providing discipleship, such that these men will be rooted and grounded and ready to be husbands and fathers, mighty shepherds in the land, men who are able to disciple their own children and teach in their own homes and do the Ephesians 6:4 thing in the 1 Corinthians 14:34, where they can be a resident theologian, answer questions if their wives have questions, and all of those verses that apply to young men or to be the spiritual leaders in the home. And if they're not trained to be that, they're not trained in maturity, if they're not discipled, I mean really discipled, by older men who want to disciple them in their homes, in their basements, in shepherding centers. Friends, we're not going to have mature young men ready for life in the years to come. Mentorship, shepherding, discipleship, these are the ways of the future. This is the way we're going to do things and hopefully do them with some success spiritually, economically, financially for future families.
And Kevin, I'd like to tell those people in Sweden and Germany and maybe in New York City, you ought to get on the mailing list and receive this curriculum before it's banned and censored in your particular communities. You know, we know in places like Germany and Sweden, anything that upsets the social order is going to be banned. And in New York City, it's just because it's more than like 44 ounces.
Folks, as we wrap up the program, you're right. We've got curriculum, what we call the Christian Curriculum Project, and we've got a couple of curriculum that we have created for high school level liberal arts. And it is focusing on the greatest Christian books written, and we encourage you to grab some of that at our website, kevinswanson.com. Also, don't forget our book, Upgrade the 10 Secrets to the Best Education for Your Child, which is my basic presentation of a biblical theory of education against the Greek form, against the humanist forms that, for the most part, dominate in our schools today. Get my book, Upgrade, the 10 Secrets to the Best Education for Your Child, at our website, kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.